Amun looks askance at Joseph. Such were the many and varied demands made upon Joseph at this time. He must not only satisfy them, but take care that his good fortune be not laid up against him, for the smiling, the downcast eyes with which men mostly greet such a rise to power hide much ill will, which must be mollified with tact, shrewdness, and consideration, thus adding another to the many claims upon his judgment and alertness. Joseph flourished as by a spring, and it is well nigh impossible for one in his position to avoid encroachment on another's field and damage to another's boundary stones. His advancement is inevitably bound up with detriment to another's. He must devote a good part of his understanding to reconcile with his own existence the outshone and overthrown. Before the time in the pit, Joseph had been without sensitivity for these things. The view that everybody loved him more than they did themselves closed his eyes. In death, and in his Osarsif life, he was cleverer, or, if you like, shrewder, for cleverness does not shield one from folly, as witness Joseph's case. The delicate compunction he had displayed to Montcalm about Amenemouye, his predecessor in the reader's office, was in the first instance directed toward Montcalm himself, in the consciousness that it would please him, even taking into consideration that the steward was by nature inclined to cheerful abnegation. But even for Amenemouye, Joseph did all he could, addressing him so courteously and modestly that the scribe was quite won over, and felt himself repaid by his successor's charming friendliness for the fact that he had ousted him from office. For Joseph, hands on his breast, put into moving words his pain at the decision and the master's whim, which must be held sacred, but which to his knowledge he had done nothing to bring about. His best excuse was his sincere conviction that Amenemouye, scholar in the bookhouse and a son of the black earth, could read aloud much better than himself, Osarsif, who could but mangle the Egyptian tongue. But it had come about in the orchard that he had had to speak before the master, and in his embarrassment told him all sorts of things about trees, bees, and birds as they came into his head. They had, oddly enough, pleased the master to such a disproportionate extent that with the swift decision of the great and mighty, he had come to a resolve which by now he probably saw was not to his own advantage. For ever and often he held Amenemouye up to his new reader as an example, saying, "Thus and so spoke and pronounced Amenemouye, my former reader, and so must you do, would you win favor in my sight, for I am spoilt to begin with." Joseph had endeavored so to do, and, as it were, had life and breath only from his predecessor. Probably the master would by now have recalled his command, if it were not that the great would never admit that they had spoken too soon or given a mistaken order. He, Joseph, had realized the unspoken regret and sought to assuage it by saying, "You must, my master, give Amenemouye 2 feast-day garments and that excellent post as scribe of the sweetmeats and the revels in the house of the women. Then will your mind be relieved and mine too on his account." All that was, of course, balsam to Amenemouye's wound. He had not known that he was such a good reader. Mostly the master had gone to sleep soon after he opened his mouth. He told himself that since he had had to leave to find it out, he must perforce be satisfied with his congé. Likewise, his successor's pangs of conscience did him good in his very soul, as also the master's supposed regret. And when he did actually receive the fine garments and the excellent post of Master of Revels in Petipre's House of Women, in evidence that Joseph had spoken for him, he bore no malice at all, but conceived that he had been most charmingly treated. It was, of course, nothing to Joseph to get for others good posts, since he himself, with God, aimed at supervision of them all, if as yet from afar, and dealt with all the problems at Montcalm's side. The same thing happened again with a certain man named Merab, who had formerly accompanied Petipre when he went bird-hunting and fish-spearing. For now it was Joseph who enjoyed these masculine pleasures attendant on his lord, and that must truly have been a thorn, a poisoned one at that, in Merab's side. But Joseph took away the sharpness and the sting, speaking to Merab, as before to Amenemouye, and procuring him presents and a good post, that of head of the brewery, so that he was Joseph's friend instead of his enemy, and went about saying, "Of course, he is from the wretched Retenu, and of the desert fly-by-nights, but a fine chap is he, nonetheless, with the most charming ways. That, one must admit, by all the three. He still makes mistakes in speaking a man's tongue, but in some wise is it so that, if one must give way before him, one does it with pleasure, and one's eyes light up. Explain it as you will, and you can only blunder thereby, but it remains the fact that one's eyes light up." Thus Merab, a quite common man of Egypt. It was Sa'ankh-wen-nofer and so forth, little Beauty, the dwarf, who whispered it all to Joseph, how the superseded one had spoken to the people of the courtyard. "Well, then, all is well," Joseph had answered. But he perfectly knew that not everyone spoke thus. He had got over the childish illusion that everybody must love him more than themselves. He fully understood that his rise in the house of Potiphar, irritating in itself, was further offensive in that he was a foreigner, a sand-dweller, and of the Ebrim. He knew that he must treat the situation with the utmost tact. And here we come back to those inner contradictions and factions which reigned in the land of ancestors, and among which Joseph's career was run. Certain religious and patriotic fundamentals which went counter to that career and had almost succeeded in sending him out untimely to the field. Likewise, certain factors of an opposed kind, free-thinking, tolerant, or one might say degenerate and capricious, which favored his rise. These things concerned the steward Montcalm, simply because they concerned his master, the courtier. But why did they concern Petitpré? Because they concerned the court. Because the court was angry at Amun in his temple, and at his oppressive power, the latter-day embodiment of patriotic conservatism and the bondage of tradition, and because the great at court inclined to and cultivated another god and worship. And it was already suspected which god that was. It was the worship of Atum Re at On in the Delta, that very old and mild god with whom Amun had put himself on a par, not courteously, but with violence, calling himself Amun Re, sun god and god of the empire. Both of them were the sun in his bark, Re and Amun. But in what unlike sense, and in what different way? Joseph had had proof on the spot, in converse with the blear-eyed priests of Harakhte, of the god's blithe, many-sided, and edifying sun-meaning. He knew of his desire to extend, his tendency to associate himself and reach understanding with all possible popular sun-gods, with Asia's youths of the sun, who went forth like a bridegroom out of his chamber, rejoiced like strong men in their race, and were mourned in their setting with the laments of women. Re, it appeared, would have no more great distinction among them, just as Abram in his time would perceive none between his god and Melchizedek's El Elyon. He was called Atum in his going down, very lovely and lamentable. But of late, out of lively speculation by his learned prophets, he had given himself a like-sounding name for his universal sonship, not only for his going down, but for morning, midday, and evening altogether. He called himself Aton, with a peculiar intonation noted by all. For he thus assimilated his own name to that of the youth mangled by the boar and bewailed by the flutes in Asia's gorges and groves. The sun meaning of Re Harakhte, with its foreign associations and inclination to a lively universalism, was well received at court. Pharaoh's wise men found it good to practice themselves in its thought. But Amun Re at Karnak, Pharaoh's father in his rich and mighty temple, was just the opposite of Atum Re. He was rigid and strict, hostile to every sort of wide-ranging speculation, averse to foreign influence, abiding by unarguable custom and the sacred traditional. All this, though he was much younger than he of On. The Ancient of Days was here flexible and blithe, the new, unbending conservative. And that was confusing. But even as Amon at Karnak looked askance upon the growing esteem in which Atum Re Horakhte was held at court, so also, Joseph felt, the god looked askance at him, Potiphar's foreign body-servant and reader. Weighing favor against disfavor, he soon deduced that the sun meaning of Re favored his course, while that of Amun did the opposite. Also that this situation, too, demanded exercise of tact. His closest contact with Amun, the embodiment of the god in Potiphar's house, was the white Dudu, keeper of the jewels. It had been clear from the beginning that Dudu loved him not as himself, but even considerably less. Unspeakable trouble did Jacob's son have through all these years with the pompous creature. In every way, with the most punctilious courtesy, he sought to win and reconcile the dwarf, as also by attentions to her whose arm went about him, Jeset, his spouse, who had place of authority in the house of the women, and his two overgrown and ugly sons, Esesi and Abebi. He painfully avoided every slightest affront to Dudu's boundary stones. Surely it would have been easy, standing in such cordial relations with Petipre, to push Dudu aside and to take his office. The master would have liked nothing better than to draw him even closer into his personal service. It is as good as known that he offered Dudu's post to Joseph unasked. And certainly, as Joseph saw, and had inferred also from the loyal steward's attitude, he simply could not bear the arrogant dwarf. But Joseph declined, meekly but firmly. In the first place, busy as he was with learning to oversee, he could take on nothing more. But in the second, on which he laid stress to Potiphar, he could not and would not bring himself to tread on the worthy mannequin's toes. But one would think the dwarf might have been grateful. He was not. In this respect, Joseph had given himself to false hopes. The enmity evinced by Dudu from the first day, nay, from the first hour, for he had tried his best to prevent him being bought, was not to be softened or won by any politeness. And if we wish to get an insight into the foundations and motivations of all these events, we shall not be satisfied to explain Dudu's dogged dislike as the ill will of a partisan of Egypt against a foreigner and his increase in Potiphar's house. We must quite certainly bring in those peculiar talismanic powers by virtue of which Joseph had known how to be helpful to the master and to win favor from him. Of these, Dudu had had proof of a kind peculiarly offensive to the dwarf, injuring him, as they did, at once in his exaggerated personal dignity and in values which sustained the pride and the self-esteem of his dwarfish existence. This, too, Joseph perceived. He knew that his oration in the palm garden had wounded the deepest sensibilities of one hearer in the same measure as it had worked healing to the others, that, without meaning to, he had somehow encroached on the domain of the married dwarf. This was why he had been so gracious to Dudu's wife and her brood. But it did no good. Dudu showed his dislike whenever he could, especially by casting up at him from below the reproach familiar in the stern old code, that of being a stranger, a Shabirite, and as such, unclean. At table, when the upper servants of the house broke bread together, among them Joseph and the steward Montcalm, Dudu, pursing his upper lip till it stuck out like a thatch, insisted that the Hebrew be separately served. And when the steward and the others tried, in the sun sense of Atum Re, to make light of the matter, he held to the strict letter of the Amun observance, withdrew from the abomination, spat toward the four quarters of the heavens, and drawing a circle round about him, practiced charms and exorcisms against the pollution, quite obviously actuated by the wish to be offensive to Joseph. If he had only stopped at that. But Joseph soon learned that the worthy Dudu actively worked against him, and tried to drive him away. He got it fresh and hot from his little friend, Bes Emheb. For the latter, thanks to his minute size, was extraordinarily clever at peeping and hearkening in the right places, and simply a master at hiding in holes which could never have occurred to a full-sized man. Dudu was a dwarf, too, by nature adjusted to the scale of the dwarf world. He, too, should have shown himself less clumsy and defenseless than ordinary mortals. But it might be true, as little beauty asserted, that his marriage into the full-sized world had blunted the edge of his finer perceptions, perhaps by dint of the same virtue which had made him capable of contracting it. In any case, he let himself be tracked down and spied upon by his despised little colleague, who soon learned how Dudu went about to hinder Joseph's growth. The road led into the house of the secluded. It led to Mut em Enet, Potiphar's chief wife. What the dwarf said to her, she repeated, sometimes in his presence, but oftener alone with a certain mighty man who went in and out in Petipre's house of women, and in her private rooms as well, Bekneckans, the first prophet of Amun. We know from the lips of Potiphar's mischief-making little old parents the close relation in which Joseph's mistress stood to the temple of the wealthy state god and the house of Amun-Re. Like numberless women of her social standing, for instance, Renenutet, wife of the overseer of the bulls of Amun, she belonged to the aristocratic order of Hathor, whose protectress was the exalted consort of Pharaoh, and its present leader, the wife of the head priest of the god's temple at Karnak, in other words, of the pious Bekneckans. The center and spiritual home of the order was the beautiful temple by the river called Amun's Southern House of Women, or simply the Harem, connected by the amazing Avenue of Rams with the great temple at Karnak, and now in process of enlargement by Pharaoh with a vast and towering columned hall. The honorary title of the members of the order was Harem Wife of Amun, and accordingly the mother of the members, the wife of the high priest, was called First of the Women of the Harem. But why were these ladies priestesses of Hathor, when Amun-Re's great consort was called Mut, or Mother, and Hathor, the cow-eyed, beautiful of countenance, was the wife of Atum-Re, the lord of On? These were the refinements and subtle, statesmanlike balancings of the land of Egypt. For as it pleased Amun on political grounds to put himself on a par with Atum-Re, so Mut, the mother of the sun, did the same with all-compelling Hathor. And Amun's earthly harem women, the ladies of the best society of Thebes, followed her example. Each one of them was Hathor, the mistress of love, in her very person. At the great feasts of Amun, wearing the narrow garment, the mask of the bride of the sun, the gold cap with the cow horns and crescent moon, they made music and danced before him, singing as well as ladies in high society can sing, for they were not chosen for their voices, but for their riches and aristocratic birth. But Mut em Enet, Potiphar's lady wife, had a charming voice, and taught the others, among them Renenutet, wife of the keeper of the bulls, to sing. She had a high place in the women's house of the god. Her rank in the order was next to its head, whose husband, the great prophet Bekneckans, was her friend and trusted intimate, and went in and out of her house.